Hello everybody, and welcome this week to Talking Flutes Extra with me, Jean-Paul Wright. This week I have Dr. Beth Wright, the forensic psychologist, and my daughter back with us to answer a very interesting question which has been sent in from a listener after one of the previous bite-size episodes, and it reads: what advice do you have for any musician who may experience imposter syndrome or massive self-doubt in their careers? Now, that's an interesting one, imposter syndrome. Can you explain exactly what imposter syndrome is?
How long have you got for this episode? So I think, you know, imposter syndrome, I mean, I don't have a textbook definition here, but it's that feeling that we're in the wrong place, that they've made a mistake, that they've got it wrong, and they're going to call me up and say, no, it wasn't you that we actually wanted, it was Cassandra. You know, it's that feeling that we're in the wrong place and that we've tricked people to the top, that we've tricked people to where we are, that we don't deserve the place where we are.
Yeah, where does imposter syndrome come from?
So it's rooted in feeling of not enoughness, in low self-worth, self-doubt. It's rooted in all those horrible, ugly feelings that we're not good enough. And that comes from, I mean, we're going to go deep into the past now, but it comes from sort of how we're brought up, the experiences and, yeah, things that happen to us in our life shape how we see ourselves, others in the world, and ultimately shapes how intensely or how often we're going to feel or experience imposter syndrome through new experiences in our life.
Does it only affect people that aren't confident individuals?
No, not at all. It can show up when we least expect it. And don't get me wrong, it comes up more often for those that aren't confident or that have self-doubt, because that's what imposter syndrome feeds off. It feeds off that crippling feeling of not enoughness. It kind of fuels it. But equally, we can be quite self-assured, quite confident individuals in our ability, yet when embarking on something new or having to, you know, experience something new or different, we can certainly have a wobble or a shake that, or even just a thought that tells us, oh my goodness, I'm not meant to be here, you know, or I'm not good enough for this, or they've got the wrong person. So it can show up in all of us at any time, but it's much more likely in those that have low self-esteem or self-doubt.
So I would imagine that any listener that has experienced imposter syndrome will know it's there when it happens. What can we do to lessen the psychological impact that it could have on us on the long term if we don't address that?
Because imposter syndrome does impact us, right? Mm-hmm. Again, we've mentioned this in a previous episode, but self-fulfilling prophecy. If we tell ourselves that we're not meant to be there, we'll act like that most often. We'll be hunched over, we will feel uncomfortable, we won't be perform our best, because if we're telling ourselves we're not meant to be there, then we will perform in a way that shows that we're not good enough to be there. That's a generalization, but it's, again, imposter syndrome is really evil in the way that it manipulates or changes the way that we act or the way that we perform. So I guess there's a few things that we can do to challenge imposter syndrome. And imposter syndrome obviously presents as a feeling, but there's often thoughts that have preceded that emotion or that feeling. And that is going to be things like not enoughness, comparing ourselves to other people. Again, it's new experiences can often invoke imposter syndrome. So thought challenging can be really helpful. So trying to balance negative thoughts that might come up, or if we recognise that we're experiencing imposter syndrome, trying to dig as to where that's come from. Have I thought a particular thought that's triggered this? Oh yeah, I was comparing myself to that person the other day who did this, and they're so much better than me. Okay, how can I challenge myself? Well, how can I challenge my thought or my thinking? Okay, well, they invited me to be here. They sent me that amazing email to say that they have seen me play and that they would love to have me and they would be honoured. And trying to look for evidence to challenge or counteract that imposter syndrome or that belief, that negative belief that you're not meant to be there.
Can I dig into the challenging So when you get a thought, what you're saying is don't take that thought at face value. Challenge as to why that negativity, whether that negativity is built around something that isn't actually fact.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go, so you get that thought come into your mind, how do you suddenly say, actually, I'm going to challenge that?
Mm-hmm.
That's not an easy process to do, is it?
No, but it's a conscious one that you often have to do consciously. I still have to do that consciously. It's not something that I just do as an automatic response. Because our brain, it's so interesting. Our brain loves to think that our thoughts are facts. We love to assume that anything that comes in and out is factual. But what I would say is it is a conscious process, at least at first. We name it as something that is making us feel uncomfortable. Okay, I'm experiencing this. I think it's my imposter syndrome talking. It's not fact. And I know it's not fact because it's a thought that's based on opinion or, you know, based on something that's not true in itself. How can I challenge that? Okay, let me think about something that would, yeah, perhaps be the opposite, or just challenge it in a way that proves that it's not exactly a fact or not real. So I might say, well, I am enough because I've done this before, or I've done something similar before, and I've practiced for so many years for this, and I am good enough. And, you know, maybe it's not even I am good enough. Maybe that's too strong. Maybe it's just I am enough. You know, it has to feel, when we're challenging thoughts, it has to feel real for us. It has to be something that we can believe. If we're trying to challenge thoughts with something that feels way beyond what we can believe, if actually I don't feel good enough in this moment, okay, well, I just feel enough. Let me just feel enough, you know. So it's about counteracting some of those thoughts with something that we can believe just as much.
So I'd like to immediately move beyond imposter syndrome, because you've moved into an area which I'm quite fascinated with, which is challenging thoughts. Now, as musicians, and I'm only speaking, it's a flute podcast, so I can only speak about flutes and musicians, but we have challenging thoughts all the time. It can be over a piece of music. It could be over style of play. I can't do improvisation, or I can't play jazz, or it could be over a harp part in the music that we can play, but we remember, or we have a feeling of a time previously when we haven't played it properly. Challenging thoughts, when a negative thought comes in, you've already said, is a conscious process. Being a conscious process, we have to be aware to start with that what's coming in isn't necessarily fact. What's the first steps to knowing that that thought isn't fact?
Look for evidence.
Right, so look for evidence. So you've played something badly in the past, but you've also played it well. So you got the evidence on both sides there.
Mm-hmm.
So where's the weight?
Well, that evidence is discrediting. So let's say you have the belief that I can't play this song well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to perform this in a week's time and I will not play it well. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you think, oh my God, that's a fact. Like, mm-hmm. It's going to happen. Okay. And you do some thought challenging, and you challenge that with, well, I've played it well in the past once or twice. That's discrediting the so-called fact that you once thought was to be, you know, 100% true. And that's another thing that you can do. If you were to break it down, you can ask yourself, well, what percentage of myself believes this fully? How much do I believe this to be fact fully? And you might say, right, okay, 80% of me believes that this is a fact because 100 other times I've played it rubbish in the past. But there have been 2 times that I've played this well, and that counts for something. That doesn't mean that I'm 100% going to play this.
I get that, but you're not in a great space on your practice and your rehearsal, and the thought comes in, you say, okay, I'm going to consciously challenge that. Surely your bias is going to be against the couple of times where you played it badly rather than necessarily the times you play it well, because you're feeling crap mm-hmm. about it.
We're just holding out hope at this point that that you're going to make it number 3. And
I'm just fascinated with the idea of challenging a thought that comes in.
And I think it's about recognising that the thought is maladaptive, the thought is unhelpful, the thought is not true, right? I'll tell you what would be true, okay? What would be a fact is I've played this and I want an exact number 67 times before and have messed it up.
Oh, that's okay? Interesting. Yeah, so you want actual facts.
That's a fact. Okay. That might be a fact, okay? Sure. If you can tell me every single time that you've played it wrong and you've counted it up and it's 67 times, I'll take that as fact,
mm-hmm.
okay? But there might be 3 times that you've played it well. That's also a fact. But it's the meaning we place on that, right? The meaning mm-hmm. is the problem. If I go, well, I've played this 67 times wrong, which means that I'm definitely going to play this wrong the next time or I'm going to mess up, that's supposition. That's not a fact. So name the facts, but don't jump to guesswork that this is, you know, this is going to be the intended outcome, because trust me, it will. Self-fulfilling prophecy, you will play it, you will make mistakes if you believe that you're going to.
Yeah, I just find it interesting how a thought that is of the now can potentially affect an outcome a long time away. And you've already said it in the previous podcast that very rarely does a thought you have now affect an outcome. But I do like the idea of challenging thoughts. So you get a nice thought come in. Do you sort of let that go and just think, I'm going to be very selfish? That was a very nice thought. I played that beautifully. Or, God, I did well then. Do you only challenge negative thoughts because that's the one that is most impactful?
Yeah, so we want to keep all those lovely thoughts that are floating in and making us feel good about ourselves. And the whole point of thought challenging is around reducing distress and discomfort, reducing the impact of the things that are going to shape the outcome ultimately. If I think every day for a week, 7 days, you know, if I think every day that I'm going to perform badly, I most likely will. That's because I think I'm going to, and that's ultimately going to shape how I do. And that's a way of challenging your thoughts, is maybe you have played it badly 67 times and only 3 times well before, you know. A way of challenging that might be, well, I'm learning and I'm growing as a musician and I have got it right 3 times before, and it doesn't mean I can't do it again. Doesn't mean I will. Recognize the difference there. I'm not setting an expectation that I will, but I'm saying doesn't mean that I won't do that again. You know, I won't perform it well again.
How do we address so we challenge? So we don't have a courtroom challenge, do we? Malad, this is thought has come in. Please present the facts to said case. Or we don't say, oh, hi there. Hello, voice. You've just told me certain things. Mm. How do we... I know it's going to change according to our own personality, but what is the best way of challenging it, stopping it? So what you're saying is we need to stop it at that moment that thought comes in. Mm-hmm. What do we do? Do we suddenly go, whoa, hang on.
Yeah.
Let's address this. Let's not go any further. Like almost like an argument you have with somebody trying to defuse it. Because mm-hmm. that's what you're suggesting. We defuse an internal statement.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is one way of coping with unhelpful patterns of thinking. So how do we do it? Well, and this sounds so bizarre and basic, but we ask ourselves those questions consciously. What evidence do I have for this thought? How can I challenge this thought? And it is as simple as we might want to write it down. We might want to speak it out loud. We might want to just sit with our thoughts. But equally, that might work for somebody that is just like, I just want to change the narrative. But if you're someone that ruminates, this may not be so helpful for you. So if you're a ruminator, it may be more helpful to detach yourself from any sort of patterns of thinking and remind yourself that you are not your thoughts, and to become an observer of your thoughts without placing any judgments, without you know, holding on to them as if they, you know, these things that hold immense value to you. It's just becoming like, imagine you're sat at the side of a port or a beach, you know, and we're watching boats go by, and each boat is like the thought, and they just kind of like float along as you go, and you're an observer of them, but you're not placing judgments as to good or bad, because it ultimately, yes, there are unhelpful patterns of thinking that can impact us and, you know, shape the way we see ourselves, others in the world. But that's because we've judged that thought to be bad, and inherently it's just something that is passing through our minds. It's just something that we're experiencing, and we will have good ones and we'll have bad ones. And you know, it's for those that ruminate, becoming an observer of thought rather than honing in and arguing and challenging may be more helpful.
I like that. I'm not a ruminator, but there was a mantra I learned many years ago that you just sort of touched on, which is, I am not my thoughts. My thoughts are impermanent, which in effect, you get a thought and you can just sort of let it sort of disappear into the ether. I appreciate that's difficult for ruminators. I'm more on the other side. But I do like the idea of challenging a thought, and I might start trying to do that, because I have lots of thoughts in the course of a day, because my brain works at 100 miles an hour, and it's sort of hitting it when a negative thought or a problematic thought comes in at that one moment, stopping and saying, hey, you know, we need to discuss this thought, and have a sort of, is it a little dialogue with it? You're talking to the thought.
Yeah, not so many words. Yeah, you're kind of, you're recognising it. You're saying, hey, I know you're there. I can see you. How about this? You know, you're offering an alternative position or explanation. And often, I want to bring in this idea of control here, because I think often trying to control our thoughts is like near impossible. Like, they are automatic. They're just like little lights. They're little things that cross, you know, our synapses. And they're not something tangible. They're just things that float in and out. And like, that can sometimes disempower or reduce the power of what we're experiencing. And trying to control them is like a battle, it's not worth fighting, because I'm never going to be able to, we might get, you know, a good handle or a good grip on being able to sort of like distance ourselves or distract ourselves or to be more present and mindful, and that's going to help. But ultimately, the thought is going to come in whether we want it or not. And thought blocking can be helpful, you know, trying to block thoughts by saying a particular word that blocks everything. But you can only do that for so long, 10 seconds or whatever, and then whatever will come in will come in. But I was going to bring in, and this isn't just for people that are religious, but I think this can be quite helpful. And we talk about this sometimes in therapy. It's the serenity prayer. And it says, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's obviously got a religious slant to it, but it's more the essence of what it's saying. So noticing what I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So it's a really powerful sort of mantra or saying that I think can be really helpful to enable people to start recognizing, actually, can I change this? Is this something I don't have control of? And yeah, help kind of knowing the difference between the two.
Because thoughts, you've already said, thoughts pop up. They're constantly, the process of thought bubbles. If we walk into a city, and every time a person was having a thought, a little bubble would actually physically come out of their head. It will be like this city full of bubbles, wouldn't it? Because always the thoughts. As musicians, we're vulnerable, because certainly if you're playing by memory, because you've got no notes to focus on. So you are letting your mind run free on interpretation. And all it takes is that one thought to pop in and you're stuffed. And that's a hard one, because sometimes that can totally derail you. And I know being in the present moment and being with what you're doing assists keeping the thought bubbles at bay, but they're always trying to break in whatever you're trying to do. And it's trying to find that process where, for that moment of your performance, you are there. And as you say, you've almost put up this force field to stop the thoughts coming in, because if the thought comes in, you're not really concentrating on what you're doing, are you?
So yeah, so I think this comes into sort of like performance psychology, and what you're speaking to there is accessing a flow state, so a state of full present momentness, you know, being fully present in the moment, fully focused and concentrated on what you're doing, fully immersed in what you're doing, and fully relaxed and, yeah, I'd say relax is probably the best word to describe it, but fully relaxed in what you're doing. And that's where kind of mindfulness can get can become quite helpful in practicing accessing that flow state. Because don't get me wrong, when you're doing a performance or you're naturally going to have that stress response, but it's recognizing how you might use that to your benefit, how you might control that to support you to access a flow state that enables you to just play without any thought. And it's difficult, it takes time and practice to access that state, and it may be easier to try and practice and access it before, not just in a sort of performance setting, but just in a sort of general life setting. But can be accessed through, you know, sort of meditation and mindfulness, like deep breathing as well. Breathing is like kind of, or our breath can be our anchor. It's the only thing in the world that's just sort of constant, that we always have, regardless of the situation, we always have our breath. So anchoring yourself in that can help us to stay fully focused and fully focused and fully present. But yeah, flow state is quite kind of important, but also recognizing it is a difficult state to access when you've activated that stress response.
Are you in a flow state when you're reading? So you're reading a story and your brain is not bringing in anything other than what you're reading. Same as if you're driving. You could be driving. It happens to me all the time. I could be driving and I suddenly notice where I am and thought, gosh, I've gone 50 miles or 60 kilometers or something. And I don't remember that.
So that's slightly different. That's okay. Disassociating.
Oh, yeah, of course it is. Yeah, of course it is. Now I've been going off on one there, yeah.
So remember, the key is concentration and focus with flow state.
Yeah.
But I do think this is a helpful thing to recognise, because some people will disassociate when they're stressed. And particularly you might find musicians that come off the stage and they go, I do not remember a note that I played.
Yes.
And that's likely because they've accessed a state of disassociation where their brain has, it's a defense mechanism, and you're in an acute stress response is going, I can't cope with this. Mm-hmm. I need to do it, but I can't psychologically cope with this. So you go on stage and whatever comes out, but you have no memory or recollection, and it's kind of a way to kind of protect you. We say that disassociating is not super helpful, but it we all experience it. Like you said, I'm guilty so often of wondering how I've ended up somewhere that I've driven to that's been 20 minutes.
So what's your thought then? If we're looking at dissociation, you're going to probably tell me this isn't dissociation, but some people will find not being themselves on stage, being somebody else or pretending to be somebody else, is like an actor. Actors or people play different roles, don't they, as actors? And it doesn't mean that if you see them in a certain role that they are that role. I think, well, I'm going off on one here, but I'm so left field from where we started. But what's your thought on potential for musicians to be an actor if it was to help them in that emotional state, pretend to be a musician or flute player that they admire?
Yeah, so that is different from dissociation, but is what you're describing, sort of that alter ego, you know, that creation of that persona that is the person you are on stage, even if it feels the furthest away from who you are in real life, and can be super helpful. Beyonce, I think, has spoken about this. She is Beyonce on stage, and it's her alter ego. It enables her to access this person that is the most confident, the most sexy, the most brilliant performer, that's just captivating, that is so far removed from the, you know, the mum of twins and the wife and the daughter and, you know, the person that she is at home. So it can be really, really helpful, yeah, for musicians, for performers, to create somebody that has all the things that they want to be on stage, and almost sort of switch in their mind, you know, as they walk out, they're going to be that person. I think the only thing that you might need to be careful with is, like, sort of, you might lose that sort of connection with the audience. If you are going out and being somebody that you're not every time for years and years and years, there may be a disconnect with the people that you are performing to. But I think certainly in the sort of early stages, or even just if you experience a wobble, you know, at a set period of time during your career as a musician or your life as a musician, it can be a really helpful way of just flicking the switch and just performing from a slightly different perspective.
So do you think we would lose, by pretending, we would lose our core essence that makes us, each one of us, unique as an individual performer. If we're trying to be Sir James Galway or Manuel Pahud or Denis Buryakov or whoever it is, we're losing the audience hearing us because we are trying to give them an inner representation of how we think these other people are.
So I think there's a difference between trying to be somebody else, so trying to be somebody that's already exists, like, oh, I want to be as good as, so I'm going to pretend I'm this person, mm-hmm. on, you know, I'm going to try and copy everything that they do. That's very different to creating something fictional or something, describing something in your mind as to who you want to be when you're on that stage. And I also think, like, it's kind of, and this is a, probably not psychological but more just personal, it's kind of a myth to say that you're pretending when it's you that's doing it on stage. You know, you're
yes
you're pretending in a sense, you're, there's a false sense of confidence, or there's, you are presenting a side of you that you never knew existed and you're just kind of winging it, but ultimately that's still you doing it. So whoever you create, whoever you decide to be on that stage, whether that, you know, that alter ego, whether you feel like you're pretending or not, you know, like the saying, fake it till you make it. Like, you're faking it, yeah, because that's not who you think you are going to be. But ultimately, it's still you being that person. So it's kind of a weird one because it's just enabling you to access a side of yourself that is so helpful for you in your performance, and is so different to, you know, the anxious, scared, stressed person that's going to go on stage.
We've come a long way from talking about imposter syndrome, haven't we? Thanks again for joining me this week, Beth. And thank you all for listening. Look forward to speaking to you again soon. Goodbye. Talking Flutes and Talking Flutes Extra are podcast productions by the Trevor James Flute Company. For more information, visit trevorjamesflutes.com.